Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Bangkok was hit by a second, smaller blast the day after a powerful bomb tore through a popular shrine, killing 22 people and wounding 120 others. Police say no one was injured after a grenade was tossed from a bridge into a river next to a ferryboat pier. VOA's Steve Herman.
The head of the junta, the Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha, came on television this afternoon on all the channels and sought to reassure everybody that Thailand is still safe and that they're going to find the perpetrators and bring them to justice as soon as possible, and clearly indicating that this was a politically motivated bombing targeting the economy and tourism for whatever reason.
Authorities released a video of what they say is the suspected bomber leaving a backpack at the Erawan Shrine shortly before the blast Monday evening. Those killed in Monday's explosion at the open-air Erawan Hindu Shrine include at least six Thais, four Malaysians, three Chinese, one Singaporean, one Philippine national, and two Hong Kong residents, a reflection of the shrine's popularity among Asian tourists. Rain fell Tuesday on the Chinese port city of Tianjin, complicating recovery efforts and raising fears about possible effects from toxic chemicals, following last week's massive explosions at a warehouse that killed 114 people. Some 57 people remain unaccounted for, most of them firefighters. Warehouses at the site were holding several thousand tons of chemicals, including 700 tons of sodium cyanide, 800 tons of ammonium nitrate, 500 tons of potassium nitrate. China's top prosecutor has opened an investigation into the cause of the accident. This is VOA News. Calling it strong, long-term, and verifiable, a group of arms control and nuclear proliferation specialists have come out in support of an international pact aimed at restraining Iran's nuclear program. The Washington-based Arms Control Association says the agreement advances the security interest of the P5+1 nations, the European Union, their allies and partners in the Middle East, and the international community, and ensures any future effort by Iran to pursue nuclear weapons, even a clandestine program, would be detected promptly. The United Nations told Greece it must show much more leadership in tackling the escalating crisis of migrants crossing the Mediterranean. The number of refugee arrivals to Greece have now reached the 160,000th mark, William Spindler of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees said Tuesday. Six Syrian migrants, including an infant, drowned off the Turkish coast Tuesday as they tried to reach the Greek island of Kos. The UNHCR said the Greek government has a responsibility to do more, and the European Union must also support Athens. The political controversy over the email files of former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton shows no sign of ending, engulfing her standing as the leading 2016 Democratic presidential contender. A federal judge has set a hearing for later this week on whether the State Department is ensuring the retrieval of all official records that Clinton and her aides had on personal email accounts or devices from 2009 to 2013, when she stepped down as the country's top diplomat. The State Department said in a court filing that a partial review of Clinton emails showed that 305 of them possibly contained classified information. Early returns from Sri Lanka's parliamentary elections indicate former President Mahinda Rajapaksa's bid to regain power is likely to fail. Sri Lankans voted Monday in parliamentary elections that analysts saw as essentially a referendum on Rajapaksa's popularity. Since leaving office, Rajapaksa and some of the closest relatives are facing corruption charges. Indonesian officials said Tuesday that there were no survivors from a plane that crashed Sunday in the eastern part of the country. The official said that rescuers located the bodies of 53 of the 54 people who were on board Tigrana Air Flight 267 when it crashed early that day. In addition to the passengers and crew, the plane was also carrying nearly $470,000 in government funds to be distributed to poor families. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up at this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights reports the Islamic State group is resorting to reprisal killings and other barbaric measures to crush dissent in Sirte, Libya.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from UN headquarters in Geneva. Details next.
Also in the news, the UN Refugee Agency says the number of people arriving in Greece by sea and through Turkey is accelerating dramatically.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ghana, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights reports the Islamic State group is resorting to reprisal killings and other barbaric measures to crush dissent in Sirte, Libya. Lisa Schlein reports from the agency's headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Human Rights Office says it is extremely concerned by the brutality with which Islamic State militants recently squashed a rebellion by Libyan civilians in the city of Sirte. Fighting erupted in the city on August 10th after IS fighters shot dead a local imam known for his opposition to the militants. Residents told the UN support mission in Libya that most civilians have fled the area in fear. Human rights spokesman Rupert Colville says the apparent opposition of civilians has triggered a wave of reprisals by the extremists, also known as ISIL.
The total number of fatalities is currently not known. But unconfirmed estimates received by UNSMIL range between 4 and 38 killed. By the 13th of August, ISIL had reportedly captured at least 16 men from the 3rd District, and we have very serious concerns about their safety. Witnesses have reported seeing 4 bodies hung from poles in 3 separate locations, including a roundabout in Sirte. It's unclear at this point whether these individuals were killed during the course of the fighting or had been summarily executed.
IS fighters have taken advantage of the chaos reigning in Libya by making advances into Sirte and other areas of the country. While they occupied the city of Derna, Colville says the militants killed members of a prominent family and put their bodies on public display. He says they also carried out at least 4 public summary executions and an amputation.
It seems that the public flaunting of these murders is intended to send a message to anyone challenging ISIL in Libya. Groups affiliated with ISIL have also been targeting individuals on the basis of their religion. Sadly, as we've seen in recent days, ISIL supporters in Libya continue to commit serious human rights abuses on a regular basis and seem impervious to the suffering of civilians and the rule of law.
Sirte is the only city over which IS retains total control. Libya is divided between an internationally recognized government in the eastern city of Tobruk and an Islamist government based in the capital, Tripoli. Both rival governments have conducted airstrikes against IS in recent days. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Arab League is meeting today for an emergency session. The League will consider a request by Libya's government in the port of Tobruk to conduct airstrikes against Islamic State forces in eastern Libya. The Tobruk regime says under the current arms embargo, it's not able to control jihadist elements that have been battling for control of the city of Sirte. The Associated Press reports that an Islamic State affiliate shelled the area, killed a senior cleric, and hung the bodies of prisoners over bridges in the city. Egyptian fighter jets have supported earlier requests by the Tobruk government to fire on extremist groups.
The migrant and refugee crisis shows no signs of easing up. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, says the number of people arriving in Greece by sea and through Turkey is accelerating dramatically. Over 160,000 have arrived so far this year. Most of them are Syrians. The number of migrants and refugees who've crossed the Mediterranean from North Africa to Europe this year now stands at over 106,000. That brings the total for the Greek and Mediterranean routes to more than 266,000. The UN agency says there's an urgent need to improve reception centers and services on the Greek islands. It's calling on European nations to support Greece. In related news, Italian authorities have charged 8 alleged smugglers in connection with Saturday's boat tragedy on the Mediterranean. Nearly 50 migrants and refugees died in the hold of a ship after being suffocated by engine fumes.
Cameroonians are being encouraged to contribute blood for wounded soldiers fighting Boko Haram terrorism and rebel incursions from the troubled Central African Republic. Some of the blood donated is rejected after HIV and hepatitis testing. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Health Minister André Mamafuda says Cameroon needs at least 190,000 liters or 400,000 pints of blood for its soldiers. He says the shortages are forcing medical staff to give blood needed for transfusion only in very urgent cases.
Le focus principal est la validation du projet de plan stratégique.
He says they now want to develop a strategic plan in which donors will be identified and then be followed up on. He says they will create blood donor centers in all regions of Cameroon where the blood will be tested and treated with special equipment. Among those in need of blood are wounded soldiers fighting the Boko Haram insurgency that has claimed about 20,000 lives and displaced millions in Cameroon, Chad, Nigeria, Niger, and Benin. Among the hundreds of Cameroonians that have heeded calls to donate blood for the military is 22-year-old university student Tokam Rene.
We can't carry bombs, we can't carry arms to go and fight against Boko Haram, but we can participate with our blood to support our soldiers.
16-year-old Fadimatu Iyawa says she is donating blood to encourage the military to get revenge for the death of her 3 relatives killed by Boko Haram suicide bombers.
I'm a Cameroonian and this is a civic engagement. And for me to show my patriotism, this is my own way to react against Boko Haram.
Lionel Kongaba of Cameroon's National Youth Council, CNYC, that is also organizing blood donations, says they are happy with the turnout of blood donors.
We have received more than 200 youths already. We are really satisfied and we are obliged to push it to 2 days because we will not be able to take all the bloods for one day.
Efforts to donate the blood are hampered by hepatitis B that is present in between 10 and 13% of donors and HIV, which is present in 5.4% of the donors. As Cameroon's population has increased, so has the need for blood. The country's population today is about 22 million. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Swuhib, 14 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. In Libya, the Islamic State group is resorting to reprisal killings and other barbaric measures to crush dissent. And the UN Refugee Agency says the number of people arriving in Greece by sea and through Turkey is accelerating dramatically. And Cameroonians are being encouraged to contribute blood for wounded soldiers fighting Boko Haram. And would like to hear your thoughts. on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Last month, the United Nations Security Council authorized the African Union to maintain the deployment of its peacekeeping mission in Somalia, AMISOM, until next May. The Council also extended the mandate of the United Nations Assistance Mission in Somalia until 2016. As Mohammed Yusuf reports, some injured soldiers and families of dead soldiers say they feel abandoned and that it has taken years to receive benefits.
30-year-old Nkunzimana Jeanet goes through a file full of papers looking for two certificates that show the death of her husband, who served with the AU mission in Somalia. Her husband was deployed in Somalia when militant group Al-Shabaab controlled much of the city, including most of the capital, Mogadishu. He died in June 2011 after serving 6 months. Jeanet remembers the day he was killed. He called me in the evening, telling me that he was not feeling well. At around 8 in the evening, I was called by one of his friends, a soldier, telling me that he was shot, but he was not yet dead. At around 10 in the evening, I was called again and told he was dead. Jeanette does not like the way she was treated after her husband's death. Family members of the dead soldiers were supposed to be taken back home, but me, my brother and mother-in-law, we spent one more night in Bujumbura waiting for the death certificate. We went back home the following day and we paid for our bus fare. 15 months later, Jeanet received $30,000 that was shared among the families, including her mother-in-law and other relatives. She ended up getting $5,000. An injured Burundian soldier who did not want his name used for fear of intimidation tells VOA he didn't receive proper care after he was shot in 2011 while on patrol in Mogadishu. If you get shot while serving, you should be compensated for you to have a good life. But it's not for a cause. We don't have enough means. No one is taking care of us. I'm not able to pay school fees for my children. That is why we're not happy. The injured soldier says it took years to receive $10,000 from the AU. Ambassador Mamman Siduku, the AU Special Representative for Somalia and head of AMISOM, acknowledges problems with the welfare of injured soldiers, but says it is up to the governments to bring up these issues so they can be addressed. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
An estimated 500,000 children with disabilities have been shut out of South Africa's education system, according to a new report from Human Rights Watch. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
The 94-page report titled Complicity in Exclusion details how South Africa has failed to guarantee inclusive education for some 500,000 children with disabilities. Widespread discrimination and negative attitudes about children with disabilities were identified as key barriers that have kept these children out of formal education. Human Rights Watch Children Rights Division researcher Ellen Martinez says these barriers should be removed immediately.
Children with disabilities are turned down in mainstream schools and asked to go to special schools where they don't belong. No one has carried out an adequate assessment to really understand the best learning environment for them. They're simply sent out there, placed on waiting lists, and can wait up to 4 years.
Researchers also found the few disabled children who made it to mainstream schools suffered physical violence and neglect due to inadequate teacher training. The mother of a child with Down syndrome, Doreen Moluke, says she is one of many parents who have tried to place their children in school with no success.
It's so painful seeing your child sitting at home doing nothing and knowing that your child has got a problem with his mindset. I need my son to be in school so that he can have experience opportunities and he has care that other children has got care for.
Human Rights Watch Africa Executive Director Daniel Bakele says the level of discrimination revealed by the report is not acceptable and that swift action is required from the government.
We are trying to bring to the attention of South African authorities to implement the policy, to review the policy and to make a commitment to address the problem from the root causes.
The South African Human Rights Commission says it will do all it can to ensure the recommendations of the report are implemented. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Twenty minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Nigeria has one of the highest numbers of malnourished children in the world. But new information shows that a program run by the Nigerian government and the UN Children's Fund is saving lives by getting kids to eat more nutritious food. Chris Stein has more from our regional bureau in Dakar.
In Nigeria, approximately 1.7 million children under the age of 5 are severely acutely malnourished. About 361,000 die from causes linked to malnutrition every year. The country's north bears the brunt of the epidemic, says Ariane Dewat, UNICEF's chief of nutrition in Nigeria. He says the crisis is perpetuated by a combination of poverty, lack of education, early marriage, and, in parts of the northeast, the insurgency by the Islamist militant group, Boko Haram.
In the northern part of the country, also, for instance, education level and literacy levels are lower. We also know that poverty in the northern part of the country is generally higher than we see in the south.
In 2009, the Nigerian government and UNICEF rolled out a pilot program that eventually expanded to 11 states in the north. The program, called Community-Based Management of Acute Malnutrition, works by bringing in children and their parents or caregivers for weekly appointments at clinics, where they're taught about topics like nutrition and breastfeeding. The children are weighed and checked for illnesses. The families leave with supplies of high-nutrition food for the children. The program appears to be getting results. Dewat says the data released this week shows the program has cured up to 830,000 children of malnutrition and saved thousands of lives.
More than 200,000 children are alive today. They wouldn't have been alive if the program wouldn't have been there.
Much remains to be done in Nigeria and elsewhere. UNICEF says the 1.7 million malnourished children under 5 in Nigeria account for just a tenth of the total worldwide. Chris Stein for VOA News, Dakar.
A number of Kenyan women are turning what used to be an emergency birth procedure into a must-have in some hospitals. The increase in effective C-sections mirrors a trend in the West and is happening despite warning from medical experts who say it should remain a last resort. Rael Ombor has more from Nairobi.
In Kenya, C-section delivery is becoming more common within the urban population, especially among the well-to-do. The women who opt for elective C-section says that natural birth comes with complications like long hours in labor, physical pain of pushing, and permanent changes in their bodies. Jane Mukami is a communications officer with a non-governmental organization in Nairobi. She says that based on her personal research and word of mouth from friends, she opted for an elective C-section.
This being my first baby, I was really afraid of giving birth naturally because of the pain during labor. So I opted to just have a C-section done. And then my peers also were telling me how painful it is, and some even fainted and all that. So I was really scared. And then there's another issue. Okay, when you give birth naturally, you know, like you can't like be intimate for a number of months maybe with your husband, and I didn't want to have it that way, so C-section was the best option for me.
Dr. Peter Murimi is a gynecologist at Nyeri Aga Khan Hospital. He says this trend is growing at an alarming rate among young women and is steered by bad advice and misconceptions.
There's a new trend emerging, especially among young women, whereby most of them, by the time they reach they're almost term. That is, they are completing their 9 months. Most of them are opting to have a cesarean section delivery rather than go the natural process because they are fearing the pain. Some are saying that if you have a natural birth, you may have damage in the birth canal and everything, and that may bring out issues later. But you see, those are things which are based on a fallacy, and they're actually baseless.
But Mukami argues Kenya's health institutions are well equipped to handle surgeries, and that with proper planning, any woman can pull off a safe delivery via C-section.
In Kenya currently, we have very good hospitals and very professional doctors. So, like, for example, Nairobi Hospital, it's one of the best. And as long as you've planned well for your baby, but that, I mean, you have good money and you've chosen a nice hospital where they have good doctors, you don't have to worry about anything. You'll just feel safe.
Not all Kenyan women have sufficient money, of course. And according to Dr. Murimi, about half of women who undergo elective C-sections suffer adhesions. He advises that a natural birth is safer than a C-section.
I always tell any woman who's capable of giving birth naturally to use that method. And if it's going to be a severe infection, let that be due to an indication. Do not just do that out of a preference. Let it be because your body cannot handle it. That is just the final word. A cesarean section should be an intervention. It should not be the first option.
According to the World Health Organization, C-section delivery rates are low in sub-Saharan Africa, being used in less than 2% of births. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
Well, the phrase, a thirst for knowledge, may soon take on a new meaning for millions of people around the world who do not have access to clean water. A book that contains specially treated pages that decontaminate water could potentially improve the lives of many who live in the developing world. VOA's Jessica Berman has more.
An estimated 600 to 700 million people around the world are at risk of illness and even death because their drinking water is infected with harmful bacteria and other contaminants. But researcher Terry Dankovich has developed a special book that could turn filthy water into something that's safe to drink. The book contains 25 pages, each about 1 millimeter thick, embedded with nanoparticles of silver. The pages can be used as filters to kill harmful microorganisms, decontaminating polluted drinking water.
And then there's instructions printed on the pages that says water is unsafe to drink in your village, and if you want to protect your health, we use this book to as a water filter, and so some of the symptoms that you can have if you have waterborne disease.
For those who can't read, there are pictures on the pages depicting the dangers of dirty water and how to use the book. The pages are made of filter paper and designed to be ripped from the book so that water can be poured through the paper to be decontaminated. Dankovich will present her invention this week at the meeting of the American Chemical Society in Boston. She and her colleagues field-tested the drinkable book in Bangladesh, Ghana, and South Africa, where it was well-received. Dankovich was asked whether she'd consider printing classic literature on the book's pages.
The idea of classical text, that's interesting, maybe later, but we have discussed a little bit more exciting text, but we haven't really had the time to go through that part.
Dankovich said the text is written with food-safe ink, and each page can filter up to 100 liters of water. The work is being supported by the non-governmental organization Water for Life at a cost to produce of pennies per page. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
What What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bungani in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. In Libya, the Islamic State group is resorting to reprisal killings and other barbaric measures to crush dissent. And the UN Refugee Agency says the number of people arriving in Greece by sea and through Turkey is accelerating dramatically. Coming up, we'll have music from Ghana and in our feature segment, part two of our series on Eritrean migrants. I'm Kim Lewis with the Hayes Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're beginning in the Chinese capital.
Kim, let's begin in Beijing, where it's a big week for the International Association of Athletics Federations, or IAAF. Track and field's world governing body will elect a new president Wednesday. And then 3 days later, on Saturday, the 2015 World Championships in Athletics will officially open at the Beijing National Stadium, nicknamed the Bird's Nest. It's the largest sporting event to take place at the Bird's Nest since the 2008 Olympics. This evening, we'll focus on the IAAF presidential election. There are two candidates, former Olympic champion Sebastian Coe of Britain and Sergei Bubka of Ukraine. One of them will replace Senegal's Lamine Diack, who first became the IAAF president in 1999. The election will be held by electronic ballot among the IAAF's 214 member federations. The vote will take place against the backdrop of intense criticism of the IAAF after media reports that it's failed to act on evidence of widespread blood doping in the sport. The 58-year-old Ko won four Olympic medals for Britain, two gold at 1,500 meters and two silver at 800 meters. He says the vast majority of athletes are clean and systems are in place to fight drug abuse, but he's also calling for the establishment of a values commission.
I think it's very important that we make sure that all the systems we have in place and all the partnerships that we have, including our work with WADA and all the 214 federations, and the education for young people. So one of my proposals is to set up a values commission that will allow young people to understand about the history of their sport, the tradition of their sport. And if you look back at the history and the tradition of their sport, they will also understand that athletes like me, athletes like Michael Johnson, athletes like Sir Roger Bannister, athletes like Herb Elliott competed at a very high level and did not need to fall back on measures that lacked integrity. And this is really important, that young people understand what the moral framework of our sport is. And that's why the creation of a values commission that will be in large part shaped by young people, I think, will make an important addition to the weaponry that we have available to us.
Sebastian Coe is being challenged on Wednesday by 51-year-old Sergei Bubka, one of the greatest pole vaulters in history, who won an Olympic gold medal and six consecutive world titles between 1983 and 1997. Like Ko, Bubka is focusing on ways to reach out and engage young people and make the sport more popular.
Today we can approach on the square, on the street, indoor music. It must be attractive, must be spectacle, must be show. And this way we should go to attract the youth, to bring them to sport.
As for drug cheating in his sport, Sergei Bubka says the IAAF has not been negligent, but has in fact led the way in the fight against doping.
We are leading federation with many initiatives in this battle. And we were first with biological athlete passports. We try to use scientific knowledge. We invest in more than any other federation. And we will continue. We've been in favor for band life for years. And this is we will continue to do. But we must do according to the rules and regulation. If we need to strengthen them, we will strengthen them.
You might say Sergei Bubka got some heavyweight backing ahead of Wednesday's IAAF presidential election. Fellow Ukrainian and former world heavyweight boxing champion Vitali Klitschko describes Bubka as an icon for athletics, and he's had an incredibly powerful, positive impact on the sport.
Hey, g'day, mates. Remember me? This is the old sports emperor with a red-hot listening tip. That's right. Give a listen to my pal, the bright and lively sunny man on the sunny side of sports, right here on the Voice of America.
If you were to talk to us from the deepest, better part of the bottom of your heart... Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
Thanks, Shaka. My Voice of America colleague Shaka Sali will be waiting for you Wednesday night at 18:30 UTC with another edition of his Straight Talk Africa program. Another big sports election will take place February 26, 2016, when World Football's corruption-stained governing body FIFA holds a special vote to elect a new leader to succeed Sepp Blatter. One of the early favorites is 60-year-old Michel Platini, the former French star who has headed the European Football Confederation, UEFA, for 8 years. Jordan's Prince Ali bin Al Hussein, who lost to Blatter in the May election, has also been described as a top contender. Meanwhile, one of the long-shot candidates is Moussa Bilitti, the president of the Liberia Football Association. My VOA colleague James Buddy reached him by phone in Monrovia and asked him, why are you running for FIFA president?
At this time, FIFA needs reform, and those who have nothing to do with what has brought it to this level must be given the chance to revamp it. It cannot be those who have been running it, either in the past or in a very, very recent past. It's absolutely not acceptable. So among the candidates that are running, I think I'm the most viable, most suitable. And also, we have had a situation where since the formation of FIFA, all of the presidents, the past president of FIFA, has been European. Even the one president that was from the Americas, Brazil to be specific, is half European. So basically, all of the presidents have had some European origin. It's time to move football around. It's time to allow the rest of the world to feel and test the leadership of the organization. That would be more confidence. That would be more resonance with the rest of the world. This is not a European Union to say that all heads of the organization must come from Europe.
You said FIFA needs reform. What sort of reforms do you think FIFA needs?
It needs to be more transparent. I mean, we're all aware of everything that's going on. the decision-making process has to be more robust. It has to be more people-friendly. It has to reflect what the organization is about. So we have to change the way decisions are made. We have to change the accountability level. We have to make sure that where the world attention is, there's credibility.
As president of the Liberia Football Association, what have you done to propel you to be president of FIFA?
I've changed Liberian football. I've done several things that have never been done in the history of Liberia. 168 years old, Liberia has never had a football technical center before. I've got Liberia one. 168 years old, Liberia has never had a football development program. I have got Liberia one. 168 years old, Liberia has never reached to the level of having trained A-class, A-lesson certified coaches. I have got them one. For the first time in the history of this country, the Liberia Football Association has managed the national team and bowled 90% of the budget of the national team. In the last 5 years, since I have been president of LFA, we have spent almost $11 million on the various national teams. 10 of those $11 million have come from the Liberia Football Association. In the past, 100% of everything that the Liberia Football Association spent came from government. Under my administration, 90% of everything came from the Liberia Football Association. I think that's a change. Beyond that, I've created assets for the Liberia Football Association. I bought property. Now they're going to have the headquarters for the first time in the history of the Liberia Football Association. Now they're going to have property worth at least $1.5 million. So I've done much more.
The allegation that FIFA is corrupt, or the leadership, that has been the theme almost since the scandal began. If you are elected president, what are you going to do to deal with that?
One of the reasons why we see all this corruption of our vote is that we have removed the secret vote system for the bidding of World Cup. When you are bidding for the World Cup, countries will be allowed to present their cases to the entire Congress, and each nation will stand up and declare who they are going to vote for. And that decision will be made public, and everybody will know where you stand, and there's no need for corruption and bribery.
I want to ask you about the Lone Star of Liberia. How is the team?
We're good. We're getting ready now for our game against Tunisia. Another month after, we will play against Guinea-Bissau home and away, and then probably, most likely, we'll play against Ivory Coast home and away. All those games will be played between now and November.
This is in preparation for
the World Cup and the African Cup of Nations.
That's Musa Bility, the president of the Liberia Football Association, and he was talking from Monrovia with my VOA colleague, James Buddy, the host of our Daybreak Africa radio show. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. I got a nice retweet from the Washington Spirit Soccer Club. The Spirit liked my tweet about Nigerian striker Francisca Franny Ordega when she's not suiting up for the Super Falcons of Nigeria. Franny plays for the Spirit right here in the Washington area. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up, part two of a series on Eritrean migrants, and next, a conversation with the Wildlife Law Enforcement Coordinator in Cameroon. But first, some music. Here is Kobe Maxwell of Ghana with Auraba.
Baby, Biara, you're modern. Biara, you're high tech. With 21st century. Session, I'm a low taker. You're not Jay Ati. So, a friend with sister. Son with you, Ati. So, a friend with Auntie. Son with you.
Kobe Maxwell of Ghana with Auraba.
Well, for many years, Eritreans fled to Israel. Many were abducted, raped, tortured, and held for ransom by criminal gangs in the Sinai. The kidnappers used the cell phones of their victims to demand ransoms from their families. From Stockholm, Sweden, Maron Estefanos tracks the flight of Eritreans on a path that shifted to the shores of Europe about 2 years ago. In part two of a series on Eritrean migrants, The Road to Libya, Maron talked to VOA's David Arnold in Washington, D.C. about the hazards they face.
Maron Estefanos has never taken the migrants' hazardous trek from Eritrea to Europe. She grew up in Sweden and works for the International Commission on Eritrean Refugees in Stockholm. Her job is to interview migrants for a satellite broadcast to Eritrea on Radio Arena. She says she hopes her reports will persuade her countrymen, despite their troubles at home, to avoid the risks of migration and stay home. Maron criticizes the government in Asmara for a military conscription that drives large numbers of unaccompanied minors to ignore her advice.
A lot of people do not see a future in Eritrea. Over 4,000 unaccompanied minors, Eritrean minors, made it to Europe. What I see when I speak to these young unaccompanied minors is they're very realistic. They know the kind of future that's awaiting them. So they know that in a few years they will be soldiers like their fathers, like older siblings. So they think fleeing is a solution.
World attention became riveted on the migrant flow to Europe this spring when more than 2,000 refugees drowned in the Mediterranean. The European Union began to debate how to handle the thousands who reached the shores of Malta, Italy, and Greece. But for young Eritreans, the trip starts at their southern border, where Ethiopia maintains two refugee camps, Shemelba and Mayani.
Most of these unaccompanied children live near the border of Ethiopia, so which is really easy. They don't need a smuggler. They don't need anybody's help. They cross into Ethiopia, and then they are stranded at the refugee camps in Ethiopia, and there is no way for them to go back to Eritrea. Once in the refugee camps, they are approached by smugglers who offer zero down payments to get to Libya, which means that child doesn't have to pay anything until he reaches Libya. So once that child reaches Libya, then they contact his family and say, your child owes us this much money. Families feel pressurized to pay because there is no going back.
Smugglers then drive their passengers in pickup trucks through Sudan to Libya. Maron says this is the most difficult leg of the trip to Europe.
It's just the tip of the iceberg as far as what they go through. So the hardest part is, you know, going from Sudan into Libya, where you have to travel, like, packed in a pickup, Toyota pickup cars that are not even fit for four people. They will put a minimum of 36 people packed like sardines. The car is driving 24 hours for 6 days. Sometimes it goes up to 13 days in the Sahara, where the weather is really hot. The sun is glowing in your eyes. On top of that, if somebody falls from the car and you try to stop the driver, then he would just drop you as well with that person. So you just have to continue. A woman knows already that until she reaches to Italy, she will get raped at least 3 times from Sudan all the way into Italy.
The migrant trail is managed by smugglers from many nations in the region. Ethiopian authorities arrested 200 suspects following the beheading in Libya by extremists of 30 Ethiopian migrants. Last month, the Ethiopian government announced that it is working with the International Criminal Police Organization, Interpol, to repatriate 80 more for trial and punishment.
The smugglers are always Eritreans. Eritreans use only Eritrean smugglers. The smuggler in Ethiopia will send people from the Eritrean refugee camp in Ethiopia. That smuggler will send you to the smuggler in Sudan. So the smuggler in Sudan, who is also Eritrean, will receive you and then will send you to the smuggler, to the Eritrean smuggler in Libya. Once you are at the smuggler connection house in Libya, you will be staying at the house of the smuggler, the Eritrean smuggler, but he's got Libyan partners who will assist him.
While many Eritrean migrants reach Europe, they pay a price. Some of them are children, some as young as 7 years old, who who usually travel alone without even a brother or a sister by their side. For them, payment is delayed.
The smugglers have people working under them, pretending to be refugees, approaching these young children, telling them if they make it to Europe, at least they can bring their families legally to wherever they are. So these children miss their families so much. When somebody offers you zero down payment, then of course any child would get that, would take that chance. So these people, what they do is, as the smugglers are very creative, the zero down payment attracts everybody. So once your loved one calls you from Libya, everybody knows that there is no return and you have to pay that money.
Maron recalls several Eritreans whose decapitations were videotaped and posted on YouTube. One of them, Tesfai Kadane, first fled to Israel, where asylum policies were being tightened. Israeli officials deported him to Uganda. Then Tesfai followed the fatal migrant trail to Libya. Maron has interviewed survivors who encountered other Islamic State executioners.
I have interviewed five survivors that witnessed the massacre of 62 people getting killed by ISIS. So these five unaccompanied children, they managed to escape.
For the thousands of Eritreans who reached Libya's shore and a small boat that may sink, Italy is not far away. This is David Arnold reporting for VOA from Washington, D.C.
In 2012, there was international uproar when poachers penetrated the Buba Njida National Park in northern Cameroon. They killed over 200 elephants and carted away their tusks. The government responded by deploying soldiers to guard the wildlife reserve and halt the dissemination of the elephants. However, 3 years later, statistics show the continuing slaughter of the remaining elephants. Alain Bernard Ononino is a wildlife law enforcement coordinator with the Worldwide Fund for Nature in Cameroon. VOA's Interiake Divine Jr. and Douala asked him for an update on the situation.
It's true that in an ideal world, we can aim for zero poaching, but it would be quite ambitious to think that one day there will be no poaching as far as elephant is concerned. What we are trying to do is to reduce the scope of the situation, because actually the situation is really alarming. You probably know about the situation of hundreds of elephants that have been killed in the north of Cameroon. But also in the forest area, there are on a daily basis reports about killings of elephants.
Can we get some statistics for last year, probably for early 2015 too?
Well, as far as ivory seizures is concerned, we can talk of something like 250 ivory tusks that has been seized. So this represents something like 125 elephants killed. But the number is also very low compared to the real situation, because as you can imagine, some of these situations are not reported at all, meaning that the ivory is not seized, the poachers are not arrested, they continue the sad activity freely. But according to the statistic of the seizure is quite alarming already.
So what explains these decimation trends? What accounts for the fact that despite the fight you've been putting up, the trends still continue?
Well, the main driving factor is the high demand. The high demand, especially the international demand, mostly from Southeast Asia, China, Thailand, and other Asian countries. And the effect here in the field is that there is an increase, a serious increase in the price of ivory.
Why?
This is the law of the market. The more there is a demand, the higher the price increase. So this is why more efforts have to be put in place in order to make sure that the demand is lower. and that could also lead to a decrease in the price of ivory. Because with this, with the actual status of the price of ivory, a lot of people now turn themselves into ivory trafficking.
I understand that there are lots and lots of reposed mechanisms in place. Why are they not sufficiently bearing any fruits? Who are you blaming? The government of Cameroon, for example?
Well, it is true that the government is putting a lot of effort in fighting poaching and illegal wildlife trade because you also maybe know that the bee, that this our elite unit, army unit, has been assigned especially by the head of state to support the wildlife administration in the fight against poaching. There is also a quite good improvement in the training of wildlife rangers. And there is also something that is being done in terms of collaboration between administration. But all those efforts sometimes have not do not give the good rewards, the good fruits at the end of the day, and this is why we need to continue to support the efforts of the government. We need to continue to advocate for more equipment of EcoGuards, for instance, for more collaboration amongst administration, and also for zero tolerance in as far as wildlife crime is concerned, so that people, when they are arrested, when they are suspected to be involved in those activities, are fully sentenced or are sentenced to the full extent of the law.
That was Alain Bernard Ononino, a law enforcement coordinator with the Worldwide Fund for Nature in Cameroon. He was speaking with reporter Divine Ntarike. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The president of Guinea-Bissau, José Mário Vaz, has fired the prime minister and dismissed the government following escalating disagreements with Prime Minister Domingos Chimos Pereira. The rift threatens the stability seen there since the free and fair elections of 2014. The United States is carefully watching the political situation in Guinea-Bissau. We call on leaders to seek dialogue and consensus in resolving this crisis in a manner that serves the best interests of the Bissau-Guinean people. We commend the calm reaction of all parties and call on security forces, civil society, and political leaders to continue to act peacefully and in accordance with the Constitution and the rule of law. Managing political disagreement is a natural part of democratic rule, and we encourage continued constructive dialogue between leaders. At the March 2015 Brussels International Conference for Guinea-Bissau, the President and Prime Minister presented a vision of political and economic development for the country that garnered the support of the international community. The best hope for further progress on this agenda is for leaders to quickly come together and recommit themselves to the stated objectives. The United States looks to Bissau-Guinean leaders to show the world they can work together with the international community to move forward with political and economic development.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, Tanzanian President Jakaya Kikwete's second five-year term is nearly over. On October 25th, the nation's voters head to the polls to choose a leader. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests for an in-depth discussion on the Tanzanian elections and the role of the opposition in the upcoming vote. That's next time on VOA Africa.